couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, the new movies I'm going to be talking about include Hobbs and Shaw, Skin, and Maiden. I'm also going to be talking about some news and the trailer park and the home cinema roundup featuring a trifecta of horror films from the past, Quatermass 2, Quatermass and the Pit, and Lust for a Vampire, a children's story. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The piece of news that hit my radar this week isn't one that actually got populated out into regular news. It's not something you may have even heard of. There is a site, it's called Letterboxd, without an E at the end, so LetterboxD.com. What it is it's a site where essentially you can log films you watch and you can write reviews and you can follow other people. It's a social media site, but it's based on film and reviews. Apparently what happened is because this last week with Quentin Tarantino's latest film coming out, a lot of people went back and looked at his older films. And this guy watched Inglourious Basterds, which is a 10-year-old movie. And in the review, he lamented of the fact that these characters in the movie, the group of the Inglourious Basterds, were Nazi killers. And he lamented the fact that we didn't have any of those left. And I don't know the actual language he used because the review was taken down, but he essentially made a somewhat humorous aside that, you know, hey, we wiped out fascism in World War II. Wouldn't it be great if we had people running around doing this now? Because as you know, there's a certain popularity of white supremacy and skinheadism and neo-Nazis and just plain old Nazis showing up again in this great nation of ours. And Letterboxd, apparently the review was reported and they took it down. Now, like I said, I have not seen the actual review because it was deleted off the service. But the guy complained because he's like, wait a minute, why'd you take this down? And like, well, it violates our community policy. And they tried to handle it over Twitter. They were like, well, it's inciting violence. It doesn't matter what side you're talking about if you're inciting violence. And the guy kind of rightfully so made a stink about this because he was writing a review. Now, again, I don't know exactly what the language was, but my question would be if a review that laments the fact we don't have a group that runs around and takes care of Nazis now, in response to a movie about explicitly killing Nazis, how is that review a call to violence when the movie isn't? How do you take a movie like Captain America, the First Avenger, in which there's a whole sequence where Steve Rogers is running around punching Adolf Hitler in the face? How is that not inciting violence against Nazis? Granted, Hitler's not around anymore, but there certainly seems to be a group of people in the world that are like trying to, yeah, oh, Nazism is okay. Yeah, it's not so bad. We need to listen to other sides and different points of view. No, we fought a war over this. Now, there's few things that I think need to be completely suppressed that get no rights. And when we fight a war over something and win, what we fought against, we don't need any of that garbage anymore. We also do not honor Imperial Japan anymore because we fought a war against them. We don't honor the Kaiser of Germany because we fought a war over that. And I get the idea of a community policy saying, well, if it incites violence. But the problem is a lot of people came out on Twitter and they were saying, hey, wait a minute. There's all these reviews that we constantly complain about that use offensive or problematic words for the LGBT community. And somebody would like, some people actually posted screen captures of reviews that they've reported that have not been taken down that are heavily misogynistic, creepy, offensive, and sometimes inciting violence to women or gay or transgenders or even anti-Semitic language that does not get stripped out of these reviews. And yet they get rid of the one about Nazis. And of course, people rightfully so kind of had a fit on Twitter. And I even pointed, as I said, this is ridiculous. So I wrote a bunch of reviews and my reviews were simply, I just logged the last 5 or 6 movies I saw and the review was all Nazis need to be punched in the face. I say that with no irony and no apology. Because we fought a war over this. And we just had, several weeks ago, a guy convicted of murder from my home state because he ran somebody down at a white supremacist thing. The Charlottesville murder. That guy's from my state. He's 2 hours from where I live. That's garbage. I will give Letterboxd a little bit of credit here, because while they did not handle this well at the beginning, because Twitter is not the place to explain a complex situation. Because they were like tweeting stuff that was saying, no, we don't like Nazis. Look, if you have to say, I don't like the Nazis, I've never liked the Nazis, I'm not as sympathetic to the Nazis at all, you may have a problem if you have to point that out. They came out then midweek and they published a post that was a long form, thought out, cogent, mature response to this with an apology, explaining their process of moderation. I think the big problem people were having is, while you have these policies, they kind of pick and choose what they want. And that's one of the big complaints people have, that sometimes social media people who run it, they pick and choose what they say. No, if you're going to have standards, if you're going to have community standards, everyone lives by the community standards. So I give Letterboxd credit for trying to spin the problem and get it to work. But yeah, all Nazis should be punched in the face. Full stop. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit really quickly is Zombieland Double Tap. It comes out on October 18th.
Welcome to Zombieland. Life is about more than just survival. We were a family. Dysfunctional, sure, but what family isn't?
It felt so good to be on the move again.
Whoa! Oh my God, I'm so sorry. Hi, I'm Columbus.
Madison.
This is Tallahassee.
Hey, Paul Blart. Is this your dad?
My sister is gone. She picked up the boy. He's from Berkeley.
Berkeley. We're gonna go get her. We ride it, Dawn.
This is a highly anticipated sequel. A lot of people love Zombieland. I thought it was fun. I thought it was okay. I didn't love it. There was this contingency, especially from where I live, Columbus, Ohio, where there's this group of critics that just loved it. And I'm like, it's okay. They're the same group that love everything that Rian Johnson does, and they love everything that Christopher Nolan does. And I'm like, they're both imperfect directors. Look, I thought Zombieland was fun, but what made it work was there was a certain level of heart underneath the comedy and silliness. What's in this trailer is all just comedy and silliness. And granted, it's a teaser trailer, but this thing comes out in 2.5 months. So we should get something more in terms of what's the story. The next one I want to hit is The Irishman, and that opens on November 22nd.
Hiya, Frank. This is Jimmy Hoffa.
Glad to meet you.
Glad to meet you, too, even if it's over the phone. Well, you know, there's a situation going on now, Frank. Big business and the government, they're trying to pull us down.
You might be demonstrating a failure to show appreciation.
I know things they don't know I know.
You can't miss the big picture.
This is most notable because it's Martin Scorsese's film, and it's going direct to Netflix after a small theatrical run. And it's been very controversial because, of course, Netflix really came close to winning the Oscar with Roma last year, and this is where they're putting the money in. And it's like a $200 million movie, has a great cast, and it's the first time since, I think, Casino that you've had this group doing a gangster movie from Scorsese. And that's arguably where he does his best stuff. Stuff like Bringing Out the Dead and Shutter Island, those aren't his best stuff. The gangster stuff's the best, and that's really what he knows how to do. And this thing looks fantastic. And I'm real curious to see what happens with it, because they are going to put it in theaters, but you're going to get the theater distributors PO'd because they want exclusive runs and they're not going to get it, because this thing's going to be on Netflix by Thanksgiving. I mean, certainly by Christmas. It's sort of be like Roma, where Roma, after it had that limited theatrical run and it made it qualify for the Oscars, it went straight to Netflix, and we'll see what happens. There's a lot more to be said about this movie as it goes on, and it looks great. Anyways, that's it. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Skin and Maiden.
Forward and steady.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews with Skin. Jamie Bell stars in this true story of a skinhead who tries to untangle himself from the white supremacy movement.
Guys like this only have three options. Die young, life in prison, or they start talking.
Not on our American soil! Let them leave!
It's our last gig.
Why?
I don't want my kids to be around this.
You don't answer your phone, you don't show up in meetings anymore. I don't even know if you're a member.
It's time for you to come back home.
Going back.
No, you have no choice.
This is directed by the guy who won the Academy Award for Best Short Film at the Oscars this year for a movie called Skin that also involved white supremacists. It's not the same movie. It's not a feature length version of the short film. So if you've seen the short film, it's different because the short film's about this close-knit family group, and then they beat up a black guy in a parking lot, and the black guy's friends come and capture him and kidnap him, and they tattoo him so he's all black and send him back home. That's not what this story is. He wanted to get those roots and the discussion and the idea of this skinhead neo-Nazi white supremacy group, and he wanted to tell a story within that. And it's a true story about a guy who, I think the guy's from Indiana. What's interesting is the movie takes place in and around Columbus, Ohio. And I'm from Columbus. I played the movie. First thing is like, Columbus, Ohio, Nazi march. And I'm just like, oh, dear God. And here's the thing that's interesting. I mean, even though the original person is from Indiana, I know that there's a lot of white supremacy stuff happening under my nose here in Columbus, Ohio, and elsewhere around the state. And it's disturbing. And I mean, I've never really encountered it directly, but I know that it's out there, and I know it wouldn't be too hard to find. So this is a real thing that happened, and it's a real story. I think they've taken a lot of liberties to it. I think it's one of those inspired by the story, but he uses the same guy. But the whole thing is he's tatted up. He's got all the anti-Semitic and white power tattoos on his head and face and everything. So it's part of him having to get those removed, because it's kind of hard to get yourself out of that movement and then live a normal life when you got like a swastika painted on your face. But the reality is there was a reality of this movement in this area of the country, and it's disgusting. There was actually a haunted house in the Columbus area. I'm not even going to say the name because I do not want to give them any sort of advertising. But it was this haunted house has been around for ages, and they had like swastika Saturday. And if anyone showed up wearing a swastika or a tattoo of a swastika, they got in either for half price or free. I don't know what it was. And I'm like, you should not, unless you're playing a Nazi in a play, you should not have anything with a swastika on at all. If you do, you're a bad person. And if, God forbid, if you have a tattoo of a swastika, you should not have a tattoo of a swastika on. I'm sorry. But this is the kind of stuff that happens. And this is getting this resurgence. And this crap needs to be pushed down, because I've known people that could go into that. And I've known people who maybe are peripheral to that subculture. And it's horrible. And this is not something that we can be like, oh, it's okay if they're here. Because there's a difference between the government saying you can't do this and another thing for a community to say, no, this garbage needs to stop. And the people in the community, free speech protects you from the government, not from other people. I remember a couple months ago or years ago, I resurrected this review I did for this movie called Welcome to Leith, which was about this neo-Nazi group that tried to literally take over a town in like North Dakota. It's a great documentary because it shows that it's a small movement, but this crap needs to stop. And there's people who are like, you know, it's one thing to sit there and say, I like Nickelback, ironically. But it's another thing to say, oh, I think the Nazis are okay, ironically. No, you just know. Anyways, this movie's interesting, and what makes it work is Jamie Bell. He plays the white supremacist. He's the one who's all tatted up, and it's his journey going from that very angry white man to realizing that what they're doing is terrible and criminal, and it shows that he has compassion, and he understands at least some life lessons behind him and how he gets out of the movement. And Danielle McDonald does a great job as his wife, who's also conflicted because she has ties to the movement, but she wants to be out of it. She's facing possible eviction because she has Nazi ties and that sort of thing to neo-Nazi movements. So it's a brilliantly acted piece, and there's a lot of depth for those characters. It gets a little bit clunky at parts, and it's uncomfortable to watch. Especially because you don't always get the full comeuppance you want, but there's way more realism in this movie than anyone really wants to admit exists in this world. So it's a great movie. It's absolutely worth seeing, especially in the backdrop of some of the garbage that's going on in the world today. So I'm going to have to say Skin rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and do something less controversial, and that is Maiden. This documentary profiles Tracy Edwards and her all-female crew's competition in the Whitbread Around the World Yacht Race in 1989/1990.
When I heard about the Whitbread Around the World Race,
it was just something I had to do. Sailing at that time was very male-dominated, and there were just no women anywhere in it.
The Whitbread Round the World Race at 33,000 miles is the longest and most challenging on Earth.
I wanted to be part of this. I remember going to the skipper, and he went, "We're not going to be the only racing team in the world with a girl." And that's when I made the decision to put an all-female crew into the race.
Three, two, one.
It's a documentary, so it is not going to have the rise and fall of dramatic action that you expect from a regular narrative film. And of course, there are all these talking heads, so there's these people talking about it in the past. So you know that, you know the yacht didn't sink. But it's a real interesting movie, especially for somebody like me who lived through the 80s. And that was my like formative years. I was 18 in 1989. And, I remember growing up in the 80s and thinking, yeah, we're so much more progressed than the 50s or the 40s or the 30s. And look, women can do whatever they want to. Well, still, you had this misogynistic, and it wasn't even an American perspective. And that's, I think, the other thing that's interesting, because it's human nature to be critical of yourself and what groups you're part of when you're soul searching. And this doesn't have anything to do with the Americans. It's all, most of it's British, because she's British and her family's from the British Isles and Whitbread. I mean, while there's yachters in America, Whitbread's not a big thing in America. It's much more of a European thing. And this has that European perspective. So it's like, you're like, oh, for once, the Americans aren't the misogynistic jerks in the movie. But it's fascinating to look how they looked at these women. Even the reporting on it was misogynistic, and the struggles these women had to go through. It's interesting because they have a lot of video footage, because at that time, even though they had clunky big video cameras, you could videotape it. And of course, they were documenting their trip. So you actually watch them as they're sailing into the southern Antarctic Ocean and the crazy waves and icebergs and the conditions they had to face. So there's a lot of original footage from the contemporary time, which is what makes the movie work. If it was just talking heads, it doesn't work as well. But this one, you could intersperse that with the clips of the Whitbread. And this is a race that takes like 500 or 600 days. It's a long race. And how they complete it and what they do and what they have to face and sort of how they showed themselves as being an actual formidable opponent is quite inspiring. So I'm going to have to say Maiden also rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about something that has nothing to do with reality, and that is Hobbs and Shaw, and then a little bit about the box office. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. Now we're going to be talking about Looney Tunes level entertainment. We're talking about live action cartoons, Hobbs and Shaw, or as they like to say, Fast and Furious presents Hobbs and Shaw, because we can't forget that it's a Fast and Furious movie. In a loose remake of Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Idris Elba rides his magical bike around the world trying to get an end-of-the-world virus until he faces the Scorpion King and the Transporter.
Luke Hobbs and Deckard Shaw.
We've got unfinished business.
Your sister took something from me. A virus that could wipe out half the population. And I want it back.
You want to tell me just what we're dealing with here?
It's my sister. Family business.
When it's the fate of the world, it becomes my business.
This whole thing sounds really dodgy.
If you felt that the last couple Fast and Furious movies were too grounded in reality, too serious, relied too much on science and physics, and you wanted something that was a little more high octane and had more action to it, then this is the movie for you. Hobbs and Shaw is easily one of the most ludicrous movies I've seen this year. And I saw John Wick 3. Like I said, it's a Looney Tunes cartoon. I remember when Jason Statham was doing the Transporter films, I think it was the second one. When I reviewed it, I said it's like a Roadrunner episode. It's so ridiculous, and what he can do with a car. And that was ludicrous in like 2006 or 2007 when that came out. But now we've got Fast and Furious. In the first movie, they were stealing VCRs. And like by the last one, they're fighting a submarine on an ice shelf with like a Hummer and a Lamborghini. Now, I find them fun. My biggest complaint in general with these Fast and Furious movies is they run a little long. And it has nothing to do with the action sequences. I think that's fun. It's when they get the character moments. And they finally have shuffled a lot of that out. This one is absurd and silly and over the top. And at times too much. I mean, really it is. I mean, in the trailer and then in the movie, Idris Elba refers to himself as Black Superman. He basically is a bionic man. And he can fight and do all this amazing stuff. And he like never gets hurt. And which is funny because Hobbs and Shaw are people who never get hurt either. It is absolutely nothing more than just an excuse to have these big action sequences and then have this banter between Dwayne Johnson and Jason Statham. And I think the banter is okay. The two of them work well together in terms of, for both of them being tough guys, they kind of have different exteriors. Dwayne Johnson is the big tough guy, but he kind of has a sweetheart and he kind of has a softer delivery. And Jason Statham's like that street thug from Britain, but he's very classy. And so they balance each other really well, except for there's a couple moments where it just goes on. There's one in a plane. It goes on for like 58 minutes in the middle of the banter. And I'm just like, okay, let's keep going. And they've introduced another person, which I'm not going to say who it is because it's a bit of a spoiler, but they've introduced another person that probably by Hobbs and Shaw 2, he's going to be involved in this as well. And they've also got Vanessa Kirby as Jason Statham's sister, and they flash back to when they're kids, even though they're 20 years difference. I mean, Statham's in his 50s, Kirby's in her 30s. They're both descendant from Helen Mirren, who makes a small part in this movie, and that's a shame because I really like her and I'd like to have seen her do more in the film. But overall, I mean, look, this is escapism at its most extreme. I can't say at its finest because I don't know if this is a good movie at all. In fact, I have this sinking feeling that it's really kind of a crap movie, but it's fun and it's entertaining and it will get you away from worrying about all the other crap that the world has throwing at you and your personal life and the news and school, work, and all your other problems. So it's fun, it's enjoyable, and it's absolute escapism, even though it does run a bit long. And it even gets absurd near the end for an absurd series. There's no basis in science, and it doesn't need to be. It's a Looney Tunes cartoon. So I'm going to have to say Hobbs and Shaw kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I'm going to jump into the box office here quickly instead of the next segment because I got three movies on Blu-ray I want to talk about for the Home Cinema Roundup. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood did decent enough for the weekend, but it didn't top The Lion King in its second weekend. And there's nothing wrong with that. I know there's some people who think, oh, it's terrible, The Lion King's doing so well. Yeah, well, The Lion King has a lot going for it. And Once Upon a Time in Hollywood made over $40 million this opening weekend, which is actually really quite fantastic. I think that's the highest opening weekend Quentin Tarantino has, not adjusted for inflation, because I think like Inglourious Basterds would be bigger and, you know, maybe even Kill Bill 2. But it did fine for a movie that has no plot and relies completely on star power. It worked and it did well. It didn't do better than Lion King, but that's okay. The Lion King is trucking along. It had this big drop, like a 60% drop, which is not good for a situation, but it's over $350 million going in, and it's over $1 billion going into this weekend globally. I don't think they're worried if it pitters out a little bit faster. They're not going to be like, oh, we only made $1.2 billion instead of $1.5. Oh, isn't that terrible? Wah, wah, wah. Let's not have a bake sale for Disney, because here's the thing with Disney. One of the things that's happened, and a lot of people have noticed this, is if you look at, if this is year to date, so that does not mean that this is going to be the final standing. If you look at the top five movies as it is right now, Avengers Endgame, Captain Marvel, Toy Story 4, Lion King, and then Spider-Man Far From Home. And that's Disney adjacent. Yes, it's a Sony movie, but it's part of Marvel. And then right behind it, I mean, just a couple $1 million below, it is Aladdin anyway. So arguably the top six movies are owned by Disney. Huge record numbers for Disney, and they take most of the box office of the year. And a lot of people have complained. They say, isn't this terrible? It's, you know, there's no original content. It's all done by Disney. They got a monopoly, and now we're not going to get anything diverse and content-wise. And there's a couple things you got to realize. First of all, there's a couple movies in here that they already knew were going to be big. Avengers Endgame, that's the end of a 20-some film cycle. And then Captain Marvel was the bridge between those two movies. Both of those were going to be massive movies. You're not going to get that next year or the year after. You got to build up for that. Toy Story 4 was known to be a favorite. And then, of course, Lion King was going to print money because of the nostalgia. Same thing with Aladdin. And then, of course, Spider-Man. You always get the Marvel movies topping them because that's what people like. People are going to see all kinds of movies. They're just choosing to only really make a point to see the big blockbusters, the stuff that's worth spending that money and that night out and getting a babysitter and spending $150 in concessions. They only do that for the big event movies. For smaller movies, movies that don't need to be seen on a big screen, that don't need to be in 3D, that don't need to be in Dolby sound and IMAX tall screen, they're waiting until they get home video, either a physical video, physical products, or streaming it online. And there's a lot of people with the diversification of the streaming services. If it's a smaller film, people are being like, well, I'll watch it when it comes on Netflix, or I'll watch it when it comes on Amazon or Hulu or anything like that, or I'll rent it for $6.99 on Vudu with my family instead of spending $50 for all of us to go see it in the movie theater. This is not a Disney problem. This is an audience issue. It's not even a problem. It's just Disney's making what audiences want. And you can go down and look, and yeah, Us did well. And of course, there's other movies like Ma, which did quite well for a movie that cost $5 million. These are not necessarily a bad thing. You still have plenty of original content being made. In fact, you want to watch a lot of original content? Go on Netflix or Amazon or Hulu. There's a ton of original content. And you don't have to spend $200 million to make it. That stuff's on streaming services now. It's just the theaters aren't getting a piece of that. We are watching the death of theaters, or we're going to watch theaters become just a primary event piece, exhibition hangout. That may be what we're moving towards. Disney's reacting to what people go see. Because look, last year when they were doing stuff like, A Wrinkle in Time, and when they did Tomorrowland, all this stuff people went, nobody went to go see. Well, you don't expect them to throw a lot of money into stuff that nobody's going to go see. It's established franchises and remakes and sequels. And of course, you're going to get more. Actually, I think Disney's going to end up with like 7 or 8 of the top spots of the year, because you got Star Wars coming up and you got Frozen 2 coming out as well. This is what the people want. Give people what they want. And that's exactly what Disney's doing. It's just the other studios haven't figured out how to do it at the level Disney's doing. And that's their problem, not Disney's problem. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Lust for a Vampire and Quatermass 2, as well as Quatermass in the Pit. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. We are going into our final segment. No box office in this one. No regular reviews on this one. We are heading straight into what I like to call the home cinema roundup. The first one I want to cover is Lust for a Vampire. These are all three, by the way, from Shout Factory. I've been covering a lot from Shout Factory. And here's why. Shout Factory's pulling out some great stuff from the archives. I mean, it's nice that you got Avengers coming out in a couple weeks, and I'll talk about that. And I know this week there's other ones out there. There's like Long Shot, which is a fun movie, and Ugly Dolls, which is, I guess, cute enough. It's much more a video release for younger kids. But Shout Factory's pulling out stuff that you, these were the kind of movies that you would only see like late at night on the Creature Feature Show back in the 70s and 80s and 90s when I grew up. And these are fun. And it's great to see them get a new release. It's worth checking some of these movies out because they're a lot of fun, especially if you're a horror aficionado, as I am. I'm missing Halloween. I am getting ready for it. I am tired of the heat. I'm tired of the humidity. I'm tired of bugs and having my air conditioner on. I want to have the windows open, a nice cool breeze with leaves falling in the background, doing a fire pit outside, drinking pumpkin spiced mocha and running around like a crazy man in the woods naked with a knife. Wait, did I share too much? I think I went too far. Anyways, this is all me getting ready for Halloween in the next couple, which I'm not going to stop talking about horror movies, people. I'm sorry. I love them. And this is the first one I want to talk about, and that is Lust for a Vampire. In this 1971 Hammer film, a girl's school comes under attack by a group of vampires from a nearby castle.
If you think all vampires are ugly creatures of the night, then you're in for a shattering surprise.
Turn now this fresh, warm blood into a body of thy making.
Welcome to the most exclusive finishing school in Europe, where they really do finish you.
This is a sequel to The Vampire Lovers. It's not a direct sequel. It's sort of in the same series. It sort of deals with the vampires are like from the same family. And one of the things that's interesting about it is the Hammer film started in like the 50s and they went all the way through the 70s and you think even in the 80s. And they were always these period pieces, but they always had somewhat taboo subjects and that sort of thing. This one going into the 70s, they start showing a little more skin, we'll say. There's a bunch of like really attractive women in this movie and half of them are topless. And that speaks to me. Okay. So that makes me immediately interested in it. But it's also a little gorier and it deals with some, well, let's just say, hot vampire girl on girl action. So, that happens as well. And, you know, 1971 movie, that was kind of, that was a big deal back then. Heck, that stuff's on ABC at like 8 o'clock at night now. But back in the '70s, this was a big deal. This is, your typical sort of sexy vampire movie where there's the guy who's sort of investigating this. He's sort of this dandy who's falls in love with one of them, but he's kind of a weak character. And there's another guy and there's this sniveling character. But it's about this vampire who falls in love and they're facing destruction from, the village people. And, I mean, that's the level of the movie it is. And it's a lot of fun. I mean, it's a throwaway film. It's about 90 minutes long. It's silly. It's, you know, maybe don't watch it with your kids, but, and there's some special features. It's of course got a new scan of the film. And it's presented in the proper aspect ratio. It also has it's widescreen and wider screen, we'll say. But they got like an audio commentary and they have an interview with one of the actresses who played one of the girls. I mean, they're all like in their 60s and 70s now because this was from 1971 that they were the young nubile girls in this. But there's some decent special features on this one in terms of just kind of looking back at the movie and what these movies meant. So I'm going to have to say that Lust of the Vampire kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next one I want to hit is also from Shout Factory, and that is Quatermass 2. This remake of the BBC serial finds Dr. Bernard Quatermass facing an invasion of aliens that take over the mind and bodies of people near the landing site.
From out of this world it came, a horrifying terror that threatened mankind, haunting and possessing every human being within range. An indestructible danger beyond all earthly understanding.
Vincent Broadhead is dead.
Dead?
I watched him die a few hours ago in that plant. His whole body covered with some kind of corrosive poisoning, eaten away. Inside those domes are creatures from outside this earth.
Ah, you're mad.
I've seen them. Thousands of tiny creatures that can join together and expand into things 100 feet high.
Quatermass, or Bernard Quatermass, was a character that was, they did BBC serials back in the 50s. They did the Quatermass Experiment, Quatermass 2, and then Quatermass in the Pit. And in the 50s, they started to remake these movies as live action films, and they got the higher productions. They weren't done on the BBC stage. This is the second one. You can find the Quatermass Experiment. That is also out, but this is the Quatermass 2. It's the second one. It's essentially kind of an Invasion of the Body Snatchers kind of thing. And Quatermass himself, a lot of people say that he's sort of a kind of an inspiration for Doctor Who, because he started out as a serial, and then they made feature films of which they did with Doctor Who, because they did those Dalek movies in the 60s. But it features Doctor Who-like monsters, these beings from other planets that transcend time and space, and they're sort of very heady. They're not the American bug-eyed monsters that you'd see on some of the cheesy B-movies of the 1950s. They're a little bit headier, and of course, he's a stuffy professor. I think he's an American, originally, Quatermass is. But actually, even though the guy who created Quatermass was not a fan of Doctor Who, didn't like him, Doctor Who has given plenty of notice to Quatermass, and they actually mention the character sometimes as if he exists in the Doctor Who universe. So this is a fun movie. This is, like I said, it's like an Invasion of the Body Snatchers movie. And the thing with these films, both this one and the next one I'll talk about, they start off relatively small. You're just like, oh, this is a guy in a lab and they're getting these weird reports. And then they go on the field and they do escalate. They escalate to some big gooey creature that's like either a blob or some monster from outer space that's gonna, and we're talking end of the world stuff. We're not just talking about, you know, a blob that's going to eat people like the movie The Blob. This is a blob that absorbs everybody. Very Stranger Things, kind of a mind flayer kind of character in this movie. And it's pretty cool. This is in black and white. This one's from the 50s, but it's still a lot of fun to watch. So you don't have to have seen the Quatermass Experiment, or you don't have to have seen the original serials. You can still just enjoy the movies for what they are. So Quatermass 2 totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue with the Quatermass discussion and talk about Quatermass in the Pit, which is also available this week on Blu-ray. Physical discs are always the best. In Quatermass in the Pit, the Doctor helps the British Army uncover an alien spaceship under London, which still has an alien presence in it. This is the most formed of the Quatermass movies. The other ones were a little bit lower budget, and while the effects in Quatermass 2 are actually in some ways a little more effective because they knew they had a lower budget, this one was sort of shackled by the budget. This one's a fascinating movie because it's the first one that's in color, and it really has almost a Cthulhu mythos feel to it, where Quatermass is, and he's that voice of reason where you've got the army going, oh, let's keep blasting this thing and doing experiments on this ship that we found, or whatever this, they think it's a missile, like a buried missile from Germany, because this movie came out in the late 60s. So they're framing it as saying, well, the Germans dropped a missile on London and it never exploded. And Quatermass is like, are you kidding me? This is not a German missile. It's not even made out of metal, and it's got aliens inside. And they're like, oh, those are just propaganda from the Germans. So he's the voice of reason of going, no, don't mess with this. Don't dig any deeper. Don't do too many more experiments on this. This is a heady movie because it takes time. It's a slower burn, and you just think you're digging something up, but then they find things in there, and it's a little more surreal. It's a little almost spiritual in a way, but it still fully fits in that Quatermass giant aliens gonna take over the entire world with mind control and violence that goes to this bonkers conclusion. So Quatermass in the Pit takes some time to do it. And now these movies also, like Quatermass 2, I think, was The Enemy from Space is what the American name was. And Quatermass in the Pit was 5 Million Years to Earth was the American release, because Bernard Quatermass was not a well-known character back in the 50s and 60s in America. And of course, on the Blu-ray, this one has the most stuff. It has interviews with a bunch of people, film historians, and like people like Joe Dante and Mark Gatiss. It's got a bunch of audio commentaries on it, and some background, like a thing about the science fiction angle of Hammer Films, because it was mostly known for a horror film company. A lot of great stuff on that one. You can spend a lot of time watching and reliving the golden days of Hammer Horror with that release. So I'm going to have to say Quatermass and the Pit Blu-ray totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
And that's it for the show. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Dora and the Lost City of Gold, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, The Kitchen, and Brian Banks. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.